From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Voters in Syria cast ballots Wednesday to elect members of the next parliament. Press TV's Muhammad Ali was at the polls in Damascus when the word came in that voting would be extended. He reported from Damascus late Wednesday.
Because people are still coming to vote, the Higher Judicial Committee has decided to extend the voting for 5 extra hours, which means that the polling stations across the country, all across the country, will stay open for voters up till 12 a.m. Damascus time. Now, there are 250 parliamentary seats in the parliament, in the Syrian People's Assembly. There are 3,500 parliamentary candidates competing actually for those seats. Now, also what is noticeable, what we have to point out to, is that unlike previous elections that happened during the unrest here in Syria, we know that we are now witnessing a cessation of hostilities deal. And up till this moment, we haven't heard of any terrorist attack or mortar shell by militants on areas where there is elections, because usually when there were elections happening before during the unrest, usually we hear about attacks happening, mortar shells, for example, that target crowded areas in order to undermine this political process. Now, the cessation of hostilities deal definitely prevented to a great extent such attacks. So we have to wait and see up till 12 a.m. until the polling stations stop, then the counting starts. And of course, the names of the winners will be announced in a presidential decree later on.
Hamad Ali, Press TV, Damascus.
But not everyone was enthusiastic about the elections set for Wednesday in Syria. This was State Department spokesperson Mark Toner on Monday at his daily press briefing.
We would view those elections as not legitimate in the sense that they don't represent the will of the Syrian people.
Those parliamentary elections are being held under the new constitution adopted in 2012 by a public referendum, which involved 57% of all Syrians in the world. About 90% of them voted yes, providing an absolute majority of all Syrians supporting the constitution.
Can you imagine General George Patton, one of the toughest guys, General George Patton, General Douglas MacArthur, where they say, we don't want to bomb the oil because it may have an impact on the environment. What are we doing? What are we doing?
That was Republican frontrunner Donald Trump speaking at a large rally in Pittsburgh Wednesday.
So we now have Libya in play, Benghazi, all of that. That was Hillary's baby. And now what do we have? Now, what? Remember the famous phone call? Who would you want answering your phone at 3 in the morning? She wasn't there to answer it. You're right, me. I'll be there.
Meanwhile, Hollywood activist Tim Robbins addressed a crowd of more than 15,000 in New York's Washington Square Park, stumping for Bernie Sanders.
We have all been fed a steady stream of propaganda that furthers the establishment's narrative that Hillary is the presumptive nominee. This narrative is strong and persuasive. It has been promulgated for months by CNN, by the New York Times, and by oh so many in the mainstream media. Now, if we had gotten in line, there wouldn't be a problem, would there? The media and the ghosts of the DLC would have had their way, and government would carry on as it has for the last 30 years. Establishment figures would get elected and re-elected without any accountability for their bad decisions. Outsider candidates like Bernie Sanders would be marginalized and tolerated for a few primaries before falling in line with the Democratic Party power structure. But the DNC and the Clintons have got a big problem. Times have changed.
Some people think it's not a question of whether times have changed, but whether politicians and voters are changing fast enough to keep up. Margaret Kimberly is a journalist and political commentator who writes a weekly column, Freedom Rider, at blackagendareport.com. We discussed with her this week's column, Barack, Hillary, and the Libya Crime. Margaret, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don. I wish I'd called it Libya War Crime in retrospect, but anyway, yes.
let's maybe list some of the war crimes first, just to give people a little understanding. This was not an intervention to protect the people from a cruel dictator, because at the end of the day, the quote-unquote cruel dictator was dead, and the people were being massively bombed, had been at that point for almost 9 months, and the country is in shambles now.
Yes, it is. But they used called R2P, the responsibility to protect, which has been perverted every time the West, U.S. and NATO, want to intervene in this, another country. They claim that it is being done in order to protect the population. There were protests against Gaddafi, but that does not give the United States the right to change the government, to kill thousands of other people, and in this case to tell enormous lies using the ICC, the International Criminal Court. I don't know if you recall or other listeners recall that they just made up stories like Gaddafi had given his soldiers Viagra so they could apparently rape, at will. So that is what happened. They then got a no-fly zone, the only one with planes, of course, were Gaddafi. So that meant, and that was because Russia did not veto a Security Council resolution. They abstained, to their eternal regret, I believe,
yeah.
And permitted the U.S. and NATO to take over Libya. And as always in that part of the world, they used jihadists to do it. The people were otherwise told are terrorists. Every time there's some dirty work to be done, jihadists are used as foot soldiers. And the result now is that Libya is a haven for ISIS. That same year in 2011, flush with that victory, they began the attempt to do the same thing in Syria, but fortunately without success.
Yeah, I mean, the key difference in how things have played out in Libya and Syria is that the Security Council resolution proposed by the U.S. and its allies was vetoed by Russia and China, and several times.
Yes, and that has made all the difference in the world, and Russia has intervened on behalf and with the permission of the Syrian government. So Russia is the party that is acting within the bounds of international law, not the United States.
And by the way, let's go back to it, because you had resolutions 1970 and 1973 that had sanctions against certain Libyan players and the Libyan state, and a no-fly zone. In other words, there was not supposed to be any flight activity. The mm-hmm. United States used that as an excuse, as cover, for an eight-month daily bombing campaign, that there was no Libyan aircraft involved. And yet they went way outside the parameters of 1973.
Yes.
And because there was no enabling legislation in Syria, the U.S. was not able to provide an air campaign in tandem with the terrorist groups on the ground, and so they didn't win.
Correct. And thank goodness that they did not. So it was Russia having its own no-fly zone.
Yeah.
And thank goodness, and only the Syrians and the Russians were able to fly. So Libya, 5 years later, after the President Gaddafi was murdered on video, which was seen all over the world, and after Libya, Hillary Clinton famously said, "We came, we saw, he died," and laughed about it. Libya is now a ruin. They of course had a puppet government chosen, but that didn't work out. It was hard to put the genie back in that bottle, and many of the factions are still fighting. There are, in fact, more than two, Libya's been in effect divided in two, and there's one faction running the east and one running in the west, without a functioning government and a people who are suffering. The destruction of the Libyan state has meant that Libya is now a transit point for refugees created by the United States. People fleeing Syria are using Libya, seems like a circuitous route, but are using Libya, to cross the Mediterranean and get to Europe. African migrants and that was something the Gaddafi government limited, but migrants from African countries use Libya as a point of embarkation. People who claim to be Eritrean, and in addition to being Eritrean, and what I mean by that is Eritrea is one of those nations that has been declared an enemy of the West, and there are sanctions against it and so forth. So Eritreans get to the top of the refugee list. So when you read about X number of Eritreans fleeing their country, keep in mind many of those people aren't Eritrean at all. They're Somali or they're Ethiopian, and they just want to leave their country, so they claim to be Eritrean. But those people are leaving because the sanctions have destroyed their country. So the United States comes in, destroys a country, makes it unlivable, and people want to leave. Or people want to leave Somalia, another place the United States destroyed, and claim to be from the other country the United States destroys, because they know that'll get them to the top of the pile.
You know, and then the refugees get to Europe, for example. Mm-hmm. There are several scenarios that play out. One, at best, they end up being treated as second-class citizens. I've spoken with people, for example, in Brussels who've lived in some of the neighborhoods that refugees are consigned to. Then we know about outside Paris and all of the Western European cities. You have this issue where people coming from Africa, from the Middle East, they're treated as other, even if they're citizens, like North Africans are, for example, in France. That's the best outcome. Then you're subjected to Islamophobia, to all these raids, to racism, which is virulent in some parts of Europe. And you have a reaction also because of the economic conditions facing European workers. It's a shifting of blame from capital to these new immigrants. They're stealing our jobs, like we hear here in the United States. And so it polarizes the political sphere on those grounds, a la the U.S., instead of on class grounds or on issue grounds, economic issues. It's the gift that keeps on giving, as you said.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, and people, by the way, they're, you know, all of these countries that people are fleeing were either colonies or de facto colonies.
Right.
And, you know, if France and England and all these countries mind in their own business and let other countries develop and fill the needs of their own people, then they wouldn't be poverty-stricken and people wouldn't need to flee. And in the case of recent refugees, the United States, it's amazing to me, in most of the corporate media, nobody ever says that the United States is to blame for the estimated 9 million people displaced from Syria, some internally, some externally. None of this would be happening if the United States hadn't made war on the Assad government. So the United States is completely to blame for this refugee crisis. Then, of course, Western European countries, they don't want these people coming in. So now they've paid the president of Turkey, Erdogan, billions of dollars in a bribe to close off his borders to keep people from using Turkey as an escape route. So it's one of the worst crimes ever committed in modern history. And now it's an issue in the presidential campaign with, you know, Hillary Clinton being who she is, being so tone deaf, that she would laugh about having done this. Obama, of course, is smarter and knows not to do such a thing, even though he's equally guilty. It is a campaign issue, and rightly so. But people point fingers at Hillary because, of course, she made herself such a target. But the real enemy here is Obama, too. And I find it interesting that people will go on and on and on about how horrible Hillary was, that she had Gaddafi killed, that in as Secretary of State she also pressured the Haitian government to keep their minimum wage at only 30 cents an hour. They wanted to raise it to 60 cents an hour, can you imagine? And the apparel manufacturers who have sweatshops in Haiti protested, so she pressured them to keep it at only 30 cents. And it's right, it is right to take her to task for these things, but she did all these things in service of the Obama government and the Obama administration. So I just find it interesting that many people with supposedly progressive credentials don't criticize the man who was her boss. And he does not strike me as a hands-off kind of guy. I'm sure that whatever she did with his express permission. And so if people are going to excoriate her, his name also needs to be brought up as well. And, you know, in this campaign against Bernie Sanders, he's painted as this, I mean, of course, he wasn't Secretary of State, so he's not on record for most of these actions. But I think it's fair to ask him. He's not that left-wing in general, especially not on foreign policy, to really ask him, well, what would you do? What would you, and Sanders and administration, would there be a responsibility to protect? What would you do when somebody came to you and said, let's overthrow Government X? So I think pointing out her sins, while necessary, should not be the end of the story. It's a bigger story about the U.S. Being imperialistic and taking upon itself the right to decide who runs various countries around the world.
Yeah, I mean, Sanders has criticized, actually in pretty vivid terms, Clinton's role in what happened in Libya and the wrongness of it, but he hasn't really specified which part of it was wrong, and, you know, he's talking about the outcome rather than the fact of R2P and just American foreign policy in general. That he has yet to articulate, and no one else has deviated from the script at all, with one exception, with Mr. Contradiction, Trump. Who, I mean, he invoked, I mean, he attacked the very concept of permanent warfare, which has become completely accepted in the political culture here as a given. But and he invoked General George Patton and General Douglas MacArthur in one sentence, saying, what would they think of this concept, especially not even against a nation state, but like against ragtag fighters? It goes to the core of it.
Yeah, it does. And he, as you know, I like that term, Mr. Contradiction, because, well, Trump has something for everybody. But, yeah, and his reasons for opposing interventions are not mine, but it would be a good thing for to have a president, and this is one of the reasons they oppose him so strongly, to have a president who just wants to upend what has been acceptable for decades now by behavior by American presidents, whether Democrats or Republicans. The war party seems to always be in control in Washington. No matter whether the president has a D or an R behind his name. And we, the American people, have accepted this, have been told that there's always a good story, that there are terrorists, that there's, you know, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, that Syria had weapons of mass destruction, that the Libyan people were, there are always people pleading for America to drop bombs on them, if you listen to presidents and secretaries of state, and by partly through apathy and partly through acceptance of what the war party tells us and the acquiescence of the corporate media, without whom they couldn't keep repeating these lies, they get buy-in for carrying out what are war crimes by any definition.
Yeah, and you know, Trump saying this, at least having it on television, which is, because here's another contradiction. Anyone else mouthing those words, you would never hear them through a microphone over the air. They would never get there. They would turn the microphone off as the words came out, and that would be the last you hear from that person, you know, unless they're on a commercial selling Buicks next year or something.
Yeah.
However, Trump, they can't turn the microphone off because their ratings tank. People tune in. That's why they talk about him. That's why they're trying to reposition him instead of silencing him, because they have to, because otherwise their ad rates collapse.
Yes, he's a creature of the media, and he has, in effect, controlled the media in the process as well. They don't quite know what to do with him. He has been a big news story in an otherwise, an exciting campaign, especially among the Republicans, where none of the candidates were, frankly, very attractive.
To Republicans. Republicans, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why he's doing so well. Yeah. So he has tapped into the core beliefs of many people who were ignored by the Republican Party. There are people who identified as Republicans because it's the white people's party. They didn't really care about foreign policy at all. They don't see any need for the United States to be on a constant war footing, intervening, occupying all over the world. But so Trump has given those people a voice. And by being as popular as he is and being the number one vote getter among Republican candidates, he has or should be bringing these topics to the fore. But he is Donald Trump, and he comes with a lot of baggage.
For sure.
So people don't take him seriously when he is saying some things that are rather important.
So for me, this is the, opportunity that we could use to measure who Sanders really is, because Sanders has an opening to have this conversation, where before you could make the argument, look, I got to get elected. They've already tagged me as a socialist. If I also start talking about peace with Russia and pulling back the military, I'm going to be, Wallace in 1948. I'm out. But
he hasn't. But what does he say about Russia? We have to contain Putin. We need sanctions. So, it's either wishy-washy or repeating standard themes of Clinton and the rest of the war party. But so we have this situation where people will attack Hillary, but never attack her boss, Barack Obama. And never take Sanders to that, never really pin him down on these issues. So we have these candidates who say the same things about foreign policy, and it doesn't matter how horrible an American president is, how many people he kills. Those issues are never questioned by the people who are allowed to have that forum in the corporate media, the, in essence, free advertising. And any of the parties that do are consigned to afterthought, third, fourth, fifth party status. And they also would get millions of votes if the corporate media would pay any attention to them, but that's why they ignore them. They don't want them to.
Yeah, I mean, you can see evidence of that, actually. Sanders has made some scathing critiques of American policy in Iraq, Libya, and so you don't really hear coverage of that. They tried, the first time he brought it up, they tried to use it to reposition him, to tag him as a maniac or whatever, and that backfired. He went up in the polls.
Yeah.
So now they just don't cover that. They cover, some rally with a union or at a college or whatever, and that's the coverage that he gets. But if he were to because if he is who the people that support him say he is, or maybe even believe he is, you would think that he naturally, he did vote against the Iraq war, he is criticizing the Libya war, he's criticizing a whole bunch of different aspects of American foreign policy without presenting an actual vision of what he favors. If he were to take the initiative to do that, I'm guessing he would go up in the polls again, and it would be forced out into the open, and he could play tag with Trump over that, because Trump will take a feed from that too. Why aren't they doing
it? I think he ought to. Even some skeptics like me might be won over. But it seems that there's this understanding, there's this unwritten rule, if one wants to be a serious candidate for president, there's some places that you just can't go. And questioning for only somebody like Trump, who has his own money and gets to say whatever he wants, dares to go outside of those lines. But even Democrats allegedly on the left do the same thing. They don't go outside the lines either. And so Sanders ends up being, he can criticize someone who's easy to criticize, but he does not question the fundamental, the foundations upon which those policies are based, and say that as president he would have a different foreign policy. So it becomes an issue of style, of Hillary Clinton being so so tactless that she would laugh about killing Gaddafi, that is becomes the place where she's able, where people are able to attack her, instead of the fundamentals of the policy itself. And again, it turns into liberals looking for somebody more likable, rather than getting a candidate who actually will bring change and will be different.
And finally, you know, with this, we've seen two major shifts in U.S. foreign policy in the, since World War II, since the end. We had the beginning of the Cold War and the entire rearrangement of assets in the United States targeting the Soviet Union and then China and communism, quote-unquote. Then we have a turnaround in 1991, the collapse or the fall of the Soviet Union, dissolution of the Soviet Union, and reorientation to containing terrorism and the right to protect. We had Rwanda and Iraq and all of that that happened. And now the soil is ripe in the electorate for a change, and objective conditions are ripe for a change. The policy is failing. Every time they intervene, it makes the matter worse, and it's becoming obvious even to Americans. So what kind of a policy could someone articulate, do you think, that would take advantage of this opportunity for the coming sea change, whether it's directed or not, to change the orientation of American foreign policy from the top?
Well, it's, you know, it's a policy that would make that person unacceptable to the people who run things, to the rulers. But there should be a policy of non-intervention around the world. The United States has presence in more than 130 countries. I don't know how many countries there are in the world, but it sounds to me like that's most of them have an American base or port or something. There's no reason for that. There's no reason for the United States to work hand in hand with Gulf monarch states and pick off every secular government in the Middle East. For all our talk about Islamic fundamentalism and jihadism and so forth, it's the United States that has given strength to these movements. So there has to be truth-telling about what the impact is of American foreign policy. And all the suffering we see with the refugees, as I've said, it's all created by the United States. So we have to have a foreign policy. Well, we just mind our own business and stay at home and don't intervene. But that would mean changing things for people who would not like it. The government works hand in hand with these defense. The defense industries make a huge amount of money. They wouldn't make any money if the United States wasn't expansionistic around the world. So there would be some sacred cows that would be touched, and that would be very difficult to do under our present system. But the voters would want it, to have someone really articulate a vision of a new foreign policy where the United States does not pick and choose who can run certain parts of the world. I think is something that would be politically very popular, but it wouldn't be very popular among the people who need to get buy-in before someone becomes president. But that would lay bare the hollowness of what we are told is a democracy and how our government really functions. And that would actually be useful, too.
Margaret Kimberly, Black Agenda Report. This week's column, Freedom Rider, Barack, Hillary, and the Libya crime. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.